Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present veteran anti-war activist and former California State Senator Tom Hayden, who assesses the potential for a long and costly campaign in Iraq, otherwise known as a quagmire. Bill Fletcher of Trans Africa Forum, who takes a critical look at President Bush's recent trip to Africa. And Deborah Weinstein, Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs, who discusses the debate on extending child tax credits to poor families across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While President George Bush has called for Charles Taylor, the Liberian leader who was indicted for war crimes in neighboring Sierra Leone, to resign, the Liberian strongman still has one important ally in the United States, Christian Coalition founder Pat Robertson. In recent weeks, Robertson has used his 700 Club show on cable television to defend Taylor as a dedicated Christian and freely elected leader battling Muslim insurgents backed by Guinea, a Muslim country. Yet the Washington Post reports that Robertson has not told his viewers about his $8 million investment in a Liberian gold mine called Freedom Gold that was made in cooperation with Taylor's government. Human Rights Watch has praised the June 4th indictment by a special court in Sierra Leone. Taylor is charged with training and funding a rebel force in Sierra Leone that resulted in the death, rape, and torture of thousands of civilians. Further, Taylor has been condemned internationally for use of child soldiers. Robertson insists Taylor's indictment for war crimes and crimes against humanity is nonsense and should be squashed. Surprisingly, there are few people in the Christian right who back Robertson's endorsement of Charles Taylor. As Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention remarked, Robertson is way out on his own in a leaky life raft on this one. Mexican President Vicente Fox and his pro-business National Action Party, or PAN, lost a key midterm congressional election. In all, PAN lost 40 legislative seats, and the lower house of parliament is now controlled by the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, that had run Mexico for over 70 years before it lost to Fox 3 years ago. The left-leaning PRD party made big gains in Mexico City, including winning control over the city council. According to the World Press Review magazine, Fox has been on the defensive for months over a major campaign finance scandal. As reported in the Mexican press, Fox accepted $1 million from overseas donors, a direct violation of Mexican law. Instead of investigating the charges against Fox, the federal attorney general targeted the whistleblower, Eduardo Fernandez, a top banking official in the previous PRI administration of Ernesto Zedillo. But meanwhile, the PRI is facing its own charges of campaign violations. It has gotten slapped with a $92 million fine by the Federal Election Commission for allegedly diverting $46 million from the state oil company to fund its losing 2000 campaign. The Nation magazine reports that Hawaii has broken new ground for reproductive rights. It is the fifth state to make emergency contraception available directly from pharmacists. This will eliminate the need to obtain a doctor's prescription for the morning after pill and increase its effectiveness because the pill must be taken within 72 hours of intercourse. Although most women use some form of birth control, the morning after pill is an important second layer of protection to prevent unwanted pregnancies. Its use is only opposed by hardcore anti-choice groups, which oppose all forms of birth control, including the standard pill. Still, drug companies are reluctant to offer the morning after pill. In 1996, public health groups had to petition the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to pressure drug makers to repackage birth control pills for use as emergency contraceptives. Women are also having trouble getting access to new products to combat the spread of HIV/AIDS. Over 20 years into the AIDS epidemic, women must still rely on men to use condoms as their only protection against the deadly disease. So far, no major drug company has developed a product for women to use for themselves. It has been up to public health and women's groups to start research on HIV microbicides, gels, creams, and suppositories that women can apply on their own. Meanwhile, across the globe, over 5,000 women a day are infected with HIV. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
As the press focuses more attention on the White House credibility gap over Iraq's missing weapons of mass destruction, public support for the war and the president has slipped considerably as measured by recent opinion polls. The Bush administration has been on the defensive since it was revealed that the president referred to a document known to be a forgery in his January State of the Union address, using it to back up his claim that Baghdad was attempting to build nuclear weapons and justify his plan for war. But as deadly attacks on occupation forces in Iraq continue, with nearly a dozen assaults launched daily against U.S. soldiers and a growing death toll, some observers are now pointing out the dangers of what could develop into a protracted guerrilla war. Over 100 American troops have been killed, either by hostile fire or in accidents, since the U.S. and British overthrew Saddam Hussein's government on April 9th. Growing instability prompted Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to say that resistance to occupation may be stepped up during the next month, and that more American troops might be required to control the situation. Responding to the deepening crisis, L. Paul Bremer III, President Bush's administrator in Iraq, pushed up the timetable for establishing an interim government in Baghdad. The new Iraqi Governing Council was convened on July 13th and is comprised of 25 representatives selected by the U.S. to act as advisors, while American officials retain the power to overrule the body's decisions. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with veteran anti-war activist and former California State Senator Tom Hayden, who assesses the potential for a long and costly U.S. military campaign in Iraq, often referred to as a quagmire during the Vietnam War era.
Well, I've been trying to keep track of the body count, which was a famous term invented during the Vietnam War. And, of course, there's no body count kept for Iraqi victims of the war by the Pentagon. It's in the thousands, according to some academic researchers. But I thought that we ought to have some clear accounting as to the death toll of GIs. And so I've been carefully watching and counting since April 9th. Now, that's an important day because the United States just recognized it as the new national holiday of Iraq. It's the day that the U.S. troops entered Baghdad, and if you will recall, threw the American flag over the statue of Saddam Hussein, his head, and so on. So since that time, I wondered how many Americans had died. After all, that was supposed to be the day of triumph. It was followed shortly after by the ceremonies that were heavily publicized on the aircraft carrier. And by the research I've done looking at CNN and New York Times and LA Times, I might have missed some, but here's the number. As of the day that Saddam's statue was pulled down, 103 American soldiers had died in the Iraqi war. As of now, another 96 have been killed, including the nine Americans in that bombing in Saudi Arabia. That would make the total 199. Unless somebody has died in the last 24 to 48 hours. They're a little slow with the count. So what does it mean? There's been a doubling of the number of American GIs killed since the statue was pulled down. And I think this is a major credibility issue for the administration and kind of shameful because you have a president that has held a press conference declaring mission accomplished. And so there's a kind of a vested interest in understating the importance of these deaths because the story now is how to airbrush the president's image of victory. Gradually, though, I think the truth is getting out and Americans are becoming more discontented. And the issue of quagmire is this. I guess that they're trying to never officially use the term quagmire because there's bad memories of Vietnam. Quagmire's, a no-no from the point of view of the public relations people in the White House. So it's going to be a very gradual effort, but I think we do have to continue to struggle over the meaning of this war and the lessons of the war because that's what a lot of these wars are about. In certain ways, the administration is fighting the symbolism of the Vietnam War and trying to replace it with this new symbolism. And it's the case that truth is the first casualty in war, and here it seems to be the first casualty in peace.
Now, sitting here as we are in the United States, we really don't know the depth of anger that's driving the guerrilla attacks on U.S. and British forces.
No.
We hear from the administration, of course, that it's remnants of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist Party. There was a recent claim that it was volunteers from al-Qaeda who are executing these attacks. So we really don't know where this guerrilla movement is going, if anywhere. But on the other hand, is there not the temptation for the Bush administration to pour in more troops to Iraq to eviscerate the guerrilla forces that are attacking them? And is that not also a recipe for quagmire?
Yeah, that's the danger of a quagmire. You can't declare victory and pull out because there'll be a collapse. You can't be defeated because you've got your whole army in there. So it just goes on and on and on. And what usually happens is people at home start to worry about the cost, and then the military starts to complain. And I found this quite interesting, that the military families are now getting angry with the Pentagon. There was a piece on the front page of the New York Times the other day about a meeting at a military base in Georgia where there were 800 people or so, mainly military spouses, and they tried to explain why the boys wouldn't be coming home anytime soon. And according to the news account, the military officials doing the explaining had to be escorted out of the meeting because the spouses were seething at them. I mean, how would you feel if you were a soldier who went over and your family, your mother and father, sister, brother, wife, loved ones, and yourself all believed the White House claim about the weapons of mass destruction and the imminent danger that this guy posed, and then you believed that you had fought and won the war, and then you discovered that apparently large numbers of people hate you and want to shoot you, and you're being reassigned from military duties to guarding trash pits or guarding intersections like a traffic officer. It's that demoralization that sets in, which I think the White House has to really watch. But you're going to start hearing complaints from the rank and file of the military families. And when that happens, the peace movement gets a whole another dimension. First, there's the morality issue. Then there's the cost issue, and the things we can't do because the money's going over there. And then the quagmire problem that makes the military extremely restless. That eats into the Republican coalition pretty deeply, don't you think?
That was veteran anti-war activist and former California State Senator Tom Hayden. Visit his website at www.tomhayden.com. His article titled Say It, This is a Quagmire can be read online at alternate.org. Upon embarking on his recent trip to Africa, President Bush told reporters that his administration cared deeply about the plight of the African citizen. While touring five nations on the world's poorest continent, the president condemned slavery and affirmed support for economic development and extolled his $15 billion pledge to fight AIDS and other diseases. But many Africa observers are skeptical that this new attention from the White House will make a profound difference in the lives of the African people. It turns out that the president's original request for funds to combat the AIDS pandemic and resources to finance development projects in Africa have been dramatically scaled back. Congress, facing record deficits, will likely reduce these programs even further. Critics point out that Mr. Bush glaringly failed to address Africa's debt crisis, the single largest obstacle impeding progress on economic development, which is key to providing relief to a population devastated by grinding poverty. During his visit, the president focused on the U.S. war against terrorism, but said little about the five-year-long conflict in the Congo, which has thus far killed more than 3 million people. While the White House denies it, political analysts believe that the president's visit to Africa was at least in part an effort to repair damage with African American voters in advance of his 2004 re-election bid. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bill Fletcher, president of Trans-Africa Forum, who assesses the economic and political underpinnings of Mr. Bush's recent tour of Africa.
I think when you look at this trip, there's no way that one could describe this as a serious policy venture. I mean, just for example, the stopover in Uganda was 3 hours. I mean, what can you do in 3 hours? How can that be considered a serious, respectful visit to a foreign country? I mean, it's ridiculous. And so you put those things together, plus the doublespeak that we hear coming out of Washington. On the one hand, we're told that the administration is committed to the fight against HIV and AIDS and the pandemic that is destroying the continent of Africa. On the other hand, we have the same administration that is doing everything it can to obstruct countries of Africa, Asia, and Latin America from buying or producing generic pharmaceuticals to fight the pandemic. I mean, what's the real deal? So I think that this was not about policy. This was more about the election. It was essentially a photo op.
The Bush administration points to their $15 billion commitment to fighting AIDS in Africa. Is this a genuine effort in your view, or is there something else at work?
When we look at the actual steps that have been taken, nothing has been allocated for 2003. And up until last week, the 2004 allocations looked like they were going to be approximately under $500 million. Now it's unclear quite what the commitment is going to be. The other thing that is, other two things that have make one queasy about this whole situation is that this $15 billion commitment originally was for Africa. Now it's not for Africa. Now it's a global commitment. So the $15 billion is watered down. And then finally, I mean, the kind of coup de grace of the whole thing is the appointment of a former CEO from a pharmaceutical company to coordinate U.S. efforts around this. I mean, this is absurd. A former CEO? What about activists who have been involved in fighting the pandemic? What about doctors who know something about it, but a pharmaceutical CEO? Just consider for a second what is conveyed in that image.
Bill Fletcher, another part of this journey through Africa that the Bush administration was highlighting was they're wanting to improve trade relations in order to assist Africa build its economies. What can you tell us about trade relations, and certainly relating to that, very importantly, is the enormous debt which many African nations still hold and which devastates their budgets.
That's right. I think, once again, the administration clearly speaks with forked tongue. Let's just start with the issue of debt that you're raising. The administration has made no commitment towards debt cancellation for Africa. Yet, now that they've invaded and destroyed Iraq, they're saying that Iraq should be able to cancel its debts. Debts that it asserts were illegitimate. Well, the question then is, if Iraq can cancel illegitimate debts, why can't the Democratic Republic of the Congo? Why can't other countries that have illegitimate debt, why can't they cancel that? One other thing about trade is that we have in the White House an administration that loves to talk about free trade. But then there are some exceptions. When it comes to agriculture, this same free trade administration subsidizes U.S. mega agricultural firms. The result of that is that there are cheaper exports, agricultural exports, to the rest of the world. So in Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America, it is often cheaper to buy imported agricultural products from the United States than to produce them in their countries.
The motivation for this trip is thought by many, including yourself, to be primarily having to do with domestic politics, trying to put the compassionate conservative face on the Bush administration in anticipation of the 2004 presidential election. Do you think this will gain any traction for the Bush presidency among African Americans?
No. No, I really don't. I think that the manner in which this trip took place, it didn't even have the pomp and circumstance of the Clinton trip in 1998. I think also the peculiarity of this trip, the overlooking the African Union, 3 hours in Uganda, I mean, things along those lines just simply don't go over well in Black America. So while there are some Black conservatives that have been attempting to put a happy face on this, I think that the political sophistication of Black America is such that people will say, Someone's trying to run another game on us.
That was Bill Fletcher, president of Trans Africa Forum. Call the group at area code 202-223-1960 or visit their website at www.transafricaforum.org. President George W. Bush promised that his most recent tax cut would stimulate the economy and help low-income families. But right after he signed the legislation in May, it came to light that an increase in the child tax credit, which was part of the package, would not be going to the country's poorest families covering 12 million children whose parents earn between $10,000 and $26,000 annually. They were excluded in last-minute negotiations between the House and Senate. Most taxpayers will receive a $400 per child check in the mail this summer as a result of the law, which raises the child tax credit from $600 to $1,000. The poorest families, who pay no federal income tax, will receive substantially less. The Senate quickly passed the bill extending the child tax credit to these families. But the House, under GOP Majority Leader Tom DeLay, is insisting the only way he will allow extension of the tax credit to these poor families is if Congress also increases the upper income eligibility limit for these credits, thus adding another $82 billion to the deficit over the next decade. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Deborah Weinstein, Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs in Washington, D.C., which includes about 100 national service and advocacy organizations. Weinstein talks about what the tax credit would mean to poor families and how her group and other organizations are exerting pressure on Capitol Hill to release the funds.
What happened in 2001 is that low-income families earning at that time $10,000 or more could get a small amount of a child tax credit, and that amount would rise each year as it was phased in, and that would lift a 500,000 children out of poverty. It certainly was an advance. Now, what's at stake right now is only whether a phased-in increase that was supposed to take effect in 2005 will start to take effect now for those low-income working families. For everybody else, the child tax credit, many other aspects of the tax code, the tax cut that just passed speeded up the increase so that everybody else would get a bigger tax cut sooner. But they left out these poorest families. They wouldn't get their increase a little bit sooner. And that's really what we're talking about now.
Well, can you put that in the context of a poor family, like, say, a mother, a single mother with two children who, you know, maybe makes $10,000 or $15,000 a year?
A mother with two children earning, let's say, $13,000, $14,000, she's right about the poverty line, a little below it. The increase that we're talking about would give maybe on average something like an extra $150 to that family.
Annually or?
Annually. So it's not the thing that turns their whole lives around, but obviously if your income is that low, you can use that amount of money. We'd like to see the families get it. But the question is, at what cost? This is an increase. But on the House side, in Congress, the Republican leadership will only allow that to happen if attached to it are big tax cuts for people who are very well off, people whose incomes are, you know, up to around $150,000 and higher. Those tax cuts cost tens of billions of dollars, and they're not paid for, and that's the problem.
What are you doing to try to influence the outcome in Congress? Do you feel like there's anything that can be done in the House?
Well, I think it really, a lot of it hinges on what the president does. a group of 30 clergy people and religious organizations organized by a group called Call to Renewal sent a letter to the president saying, we're glad that you're for the clean and simple, fair speeding up of this little tax break to low-income families without sticking all this other stuff on it. You said you're for it. Take an active role and make sure it happens. The president can exercise leadership and influence over the House that many of the rest of us may not be able to.
Under Tom DeLay, the majority leader in the House, he's actually made some very independent statements that he is far to the right, even of President Bush, on this as well as a lot of other matters. So I guess we don't know exactly what influence the president would be able to exert.
I think he's got quite a lot of influence. Without that, it's not clear what will bring the House members to the table to do this very simple, very small thing to help struggling low-income working families.
The people who have not been included yet, the legislation, if it passes, would include. Does that include both people who pay taxes and people who pay no taxes?
It includes people who, families with children again, who either pay little or no federal income tax, but they pay plenty of other taxes. They pay, of course, Social Security tax. They pay sales tax in states. They pay property tax. Even if they're renters, the property tax is included in their rent. They pay telephone tax and all those things. So to say people aren't paying taxes is simply not true. Some of them may earn too little to be paying very much federal income tax. The point of this legislation is to help those struggling families stay at work, help to lift their children out of poverty.
That was Deborah Weinstein, Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs. The organization can be reached by calling area code 202-223-2532 or by visiting their website at www.chn.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Belinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.